You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome, citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin Jangles.
That's me. Just let that play out there, Harry. Leave it. Yeah, there you go. Maybe not that loud, anyway. Because it goes on for quite a bit this bit.
So he likes an entrance, this Ben.
Oh, yeah. Although, I'm sort of worrying that, because all of the stuff I'm usually doing is related to the military, just because that's the only thing that got coverage. So I guess it matches the theme. Anyway.
Take it away.
Yes, so in this day in history, in case you didn't hear. So this day in history takes us back to 1947 and the start of a war in what was then called Mandatory Palestine. Regular listeners will remember an earlier segment about the lead-up to this, from the 1917 Balfour Declaration to the withdrawal of British colonial troops in the aftermath of World War II. When we left off, hostilities between the Jewish and Arab populations had exploded into open conflict.
But it was the rising tension in Palestine that held world attention. Partition had brought a new flare-up in the strife between Arab and Jew. Politically, the conflict appeared to be settled. In actual fact, it had only just begun. The United Nations Special Committee had advocated separate Jewish and Arab states as the uneasy compromise. The plan was accepted by 33 votes to 13. Alexander Cadogan, Britain's representative, abstained. Prince Faisal of Saudi Arabia headed the Arab country's opposition. The Jewish state will include the ports of Haifa and Tel Aviv and the whole of the Negev Valley. The Arab will occupy the fertile eastern part. Jerusalem will come under United Nations trusteeship. First reaction from the Jews was one of joy. Crowds gathered in the streets and greeted the birth of their state with traditional dances. Britain's civic administration is expected to withdraw by May. Jews and Arabs will then govern themselves. Arab opposition to the partition scheme has been violent. The call for a holy war against the Jews went out from Cairo. A three-day general strike coincided with an intensive recruiting campaign. As in India, transfer of power in Palestine will bring bloodshed. Two states have been born. For the Holy Land, the immediate future would not bring peace. A Pathé dispatch shows the scene in Jerusalem as Jewish and Arab mobs clashed in the center of the city. Men from the Royal Lincolnshire Regiment had to be called in to restore order. All British troops will be withdrawn by May. In the meantime, it is expected that they will move out as soon as possible from Arab and Jewish areas. Authority will be handed over to military forces of the two new states. Both Jews and Arabs have issued general mobilization orders. Jerusalem rioters started fires in many parts of the city. Casualties amount to more than a score killed on both sides. But Palestine's most critical period has yet to come. With British troops away from the trouble center, it remains to be seen whether a threatened full-scale war will materialize. It will be no peaceful Christmas in the Holy Land.
Yes, and with the withdrawal of British troops in 1947 and the declaration of Israeli independence, the conflict did intensify. By 1948, the war had expanded outside the borders of Palestine, with the State of Israel engaged in a war with the Arab League, a seven-country coalition including Egypt, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia.
Against a background which daily gains resemblance to war-scarred Europe, Palestine is now at grips with almost unrestricted racial warfare. With British influence waning and United Nations action still delayed, the lawless elements of Jew and Arab populations take over from the servants of a policy of law and order. Passenger trains have ceased to serve Jerusalem. Goods trains are under fire from snipers. Primitive cowcatchers provide a poor defense against rail-planted bombs. Road transport moves behind an armor of steel plating, and only convoys with armed escort can hope to reach their destinations unmolested. In the back streets of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem and Jaffa, the thugs of both sides build up the armored cars for war against each other. In between them, victims of the struggle, stand the great majorities of simple people of both sides. nearing the end of his thankless task, the British Tommy carries on his job of clearing out the wreckage to give succor to the injured. When will United Nations take up the load borne by the young men of Britain? The Palestine mandate is ended, Britain is relieved of a burden. Sir Alan Cunningham takes leave of the troops who have shown exemplary patience in a thankless task. 10 weeks more are required for complete withdrawal. With the end of the mandatory power, all legal bars to immigration are removed. The seas are now open to the seekers of the promised land. The refugees from memories of war-scarred Europe land in a country already in the grip of bitter racial strife. Tel Aviv, key Jewish city, is all rejoicing as the elected head of the provisional government, David Ben-Gurion, arrives to read the proclamation of a new nation, the State of Israel. Born in the throes of war, with undefined frontiers, facing Arab opposition, the new state precipitates a world problem. The tillers of its fields go armed, while the world's United Nations engage in futile talk at Lake Success. Tel Aviv comes under Egyptian aerial bombardment. The city feels the type of civilization from which the Jews fled and which the Arabs seek to keep from their shores. One Egyptian raider is brought down. Abdullah of Transjordan, Farouk of Egypt, and Ibn Saud of Arabia unite the Arab world against the Jewish state. Abdullah alone commands an efficient fighting force, the Arab Legion, trained and equipped by Britain under the terms of her treaty with Transjordan. Unless United Nations declare Abdullah the aggressor, Britain remains bound by the treaty. Upon this king of a small state rests the responsibility of a world statesman. The lives of countless people hang on his decisions. May he act wisely.
Yes, and that is the end of part one of This Day in History. For part two, we'll continue. Part two will continue after these messages.
Friendly Potential presents Andrew Weatherall this Saturday at Galatos.
The DJ.
Producer of Screamadelica, general electronic music legend, Mr. Sabres of Paradise himself, Andrew Weatherall is coming to help you achieve transcendence. With a love from outer space, this Saturday at Galatos. Tickets from friendlypotential.com/tickets.
Northern Bass is the New Year's fest that keeps on giving. Vibes, Low End, Stormzy, Princess Nokia, Shapeshifter, all in beautiful Mungify. And now they're bringing you a tour from Aotearoa's legendary Salmonella Dub. Salmonella Dub 25th Anniversary Tour featuring the return of Tiki Tane at Northern Bass and Mungify, December 29th to 31st and in Taupo, February 3rd. Tickets from theticketferry.com.
こちらは 95BFM Audible World です。
The Audible World, world music treats and bizarro ethnomusicological finds with Andrew McLeod and guests.Let your ears bathe in all the splendor of the planet's oral delights. The Audible World, every Sunday night from 9 to 11 p.m.
Ascoltate il mondo udibile, Radio 95 BFM.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We now return to This Day in History. So when we left off, the Arab-Israeli war had just begun, but the next stage came when Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser nationalised the Suez Canal, which was an important waterway for global shipping.
As Egypt plans to abrogate her treaty with Britain, attention focuses on the Great Suez Canal. Built by the Frenchman de Lesseps just over 80 years ago, the 100 miles canal, which halves the distance between Europe and the East, is guarded by British troops under the treaty which Egypt now plans to set aside. The treaty gave Egypt complete independence and Britain the defense of the canal zone. During the war, Britain took over the defense of all Egypt, but handed over once again when war ended, and Egypt smiled as she took over and forgot Alamein. To Egypt, Britain brought prosperity. Once her dry lands gave plenty, only when the Nile flooded. We harnessed the Nile with one of the world's greatest dams, and thereafter, there was always water to irrigate the fields in rain or drought. Water for the peasant to draw with his primitive wheels. With water in plenty, vast cotton plantations sprung up in Upper Egypt and the Sudan to the south. Cotton, without which many mills of Lancashire would close down. Connecting the Mediterranean with the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, in the safeguard of British troops, is vital to Western security. Through its waters, our ships can race to danger points, east or west, to guard Egypt as well as the Western nations. Now, Arab states, linked with her through the Arab League, promise Egypt their support, and Iraq asks speedy revision of our treaty with her. This great unrest comes just as the powers are tackling Middle East defense. General Bradley, American Chief of Staff, seen here with Monty, was on his way to Turkey, latest member of Western defense. Egypt is next on the list, and therein lies our hope for a friendly settlement.
That 100-mile international shortcut to the Far East, the Suez Canal, was run by a company with Britain as its biggest shareholder. Britain guarded it in two world wars, and it was used by a vast annual tonnage of British shipping. Now Egypt's President Nasser has made his grab. He calls it nationalization. And, cheered on as usual by an hysterical mob, he insults Britain, who duly withdrew her forces according to treaty. The Aswan High Dam, he boasts, will easily be paid for out of canal revenue, without British or American help. The dam, in fact, is used as an excuse for recklessly and illegally taking over the canal 12 years ahead of the agreed date to end the concession.
Israel, with the support of Britain and France, used the Suez Canal as a pretext to launch an attack on Egypt. This was met with initial success until the United States forced both sides to come to the negotiating table.
After weeks of stalemate, the Suez crisis bursts dramatically into the news again, for Israel has invaded Egypt. Britain and France have declared the canal in danger, and British and French troops are on the move. Background to these startling events is the running sore of the Israel-Egypt frontier, which has been a theater of sporadic warfare ever since the Israeli state came into being. For many years, even the village schools in the frontier settlements have known that at any moment, death may be looking over their shoulder. Israeli patrols have been permanently on the watch for any move from the Egyptian side. For Israel's Arab neighbors have never been reconciled to her existence. Every few weeks, the farmers' daily round has been interrupted by sudden clashes for which neither side has been without blame. Meanwhile, in Egypt, the steadily growing power of the regime which overthrew Farouk has been evident to the world. The Western nations, thinking of the Suez Canal, watched uneasily. Egypt turned eastwards for her supplies of arms, and Russia's Foreign Minister Shapilov found Nasser a ready customer. But with every man and woman trained, Israel's strength too was growing, and the danger of a major flare-up increased. The frontier raids continued. Sooner or later, the explosion must come. At last, without warning, Israel strikes. General Moshe Dayan, one-eyed commander-in-chief, orders the tanks into action. Israeli forces sweep across the frontier into the Egyptian desert, while Premier Ben-Gurion declares general mobilization. Within hours, the leading Israeli columns are driving towards the canal. Britain and France react at once with an ultimatum. Stop the fighting or we march in. Israel accepts if Egypt will. But Egypt flatly refuses. The world waits tensely to see whether the British flag will fly once more over Suez.
And now for a song which is vaguely related to the thing we're talking about. Or is it, or not? Just technical difficulties there. Lachlan messing up as usual. That's why we can't have nice things. Is this going out? Test. No. Alright, never mind that then. Never mind the song, which we probably could have found off the BFM. Yeah, we could have easily found that off the thing. Anyway, after the Suez Crisis, the Arab-Israeli conflict went somewhat quiet, at least as far as open warfare was concerned. However, as Israel moved closer to the United States and its Arab opponents, the Soviet Union, conflict became increasingly inevitable, with what is now known as the Six-Day War breaking out in 1967.
The tension in the Middle East over the Gulf of Aqaba blockade develops into full-scale war, with reports of heavy fighting between Israeli and Egyptian forces along the Gaza Strip and the Sinai border. Earlier, the U.S. aircraft carrier Intrepid steamed through the Suez Canal, although no American units are alerted. Our State Department says we are neutral in word, thought, and deed. Earlier, a mass rally in Cairo by Arab socialists shows support for UAR President Nasser, who meets with King Hussein of Jordan to sign a 5-year mutual defense pact. The signing annoys Syria, to whom Jordan recently closed her borders. Formerly, Hussein was moderate toward Israel. Jordanian trucks and tanks roar through the desert as each side accuses the other of attacking first. Despite 2 reported air raid attempts, Jerusalem is relatively calm. Israeli Chief of Staff General Yitzhak Rabin visits and inspects troops in the Negev Desert near the Egyptian border. A UN ceasefire request is supported by the US, while Russia accuses America and Britain of encouraging Israel to attack. The Six-Day Middle East War echoes along a second front, the diplomatic struggle at the United Nations Security Council. A series of emotionally charged meetings keeps delegates debating on nearly around-the-clock basis. Syrian Ambassador George Tomei charges Israel with continued ceasefire violations, saying that Israeli tank forces advanced toward a branch of the Jordan River to establish control of a strategically important water resource. He calls it systematic invasion. Soviet delegate Nikolai Fedorenko heaps abuse and lashing invective on both Israel and the United States. In a blistering filibuster, Russia breaks diplomatic relations with Israel and threatens sanctions. Israeli Ambassador Gideon Raphael answers the truce violation charges, saying that his nation's troop and tank movements occurred before the ceasefire went into effect. Israeli government officers announce their victory wipes out previous armistice agreements and frontiers. And that victory is a swift, smashing, and total one, as crack air force, infantry, artillery, and tank corps combine to sweep across the Sinai Peninsula to the Suez Canal, east into Jordan, north into Syria. Thousands of prisoners are taken, while Jordan announces she lost 15,000 troops in the sudden and devastating campaign. Israeli spearheads race to the Gaza Strip, advance across the entire Sinai, taking Sharm el-Sheikh at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba, thus breaking the blockade. The old city of Jerusalem is captured, as well as Bethlehem, the west bank of the Jordan, and the drive into Syria stops just short of Damascus.
All right, we will now try again to play the song which we tried and failed to before.
Stop!
Right, yes, that was Rock the Casbah by The Clash. And we now return to this day in history. When we ended, it was the end of the Six-Day War between Israel and various Arab nations. The Six-Day War was followed by several years of peace, which was broken in 1973 with a surprise attack by, again, a coalition, this time led by Egypt and Syria, on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur.
From dawn this morning, the Israeli and Syrian armies have been slugging it out here high up on the Golan Mountains. The Syrians have been attempting to dig in and consolidate the gains they made on Saturday, the Israelis to dislodge them with airstrikes, heavy artillery and tanks.
The Israelis were unloading captured Syrian artillery shells, consolidating their positions on the northern sector, and they claimed they now had all of it except for one observation post. They also revealed how far the Syrians had penetrated until the counterattack stopped them. At one point, across the main supply route, which would have cut off some Israeli units. And in the early stages of the battle, the Israelis admitted to having been outnumbered 11-1. Now, however, they have for the first time crossed over the former ceasefire line. Knocked out Syrian tanks mark the line of their advance, and the question here is whether the Israelis, even with their air power dominant on this front, will take it any further. They're settling down to a longer war against stiffer opposition than they had at first expected.
After 1973, open conflict between Israel and its neighbours was replaced by more irregular wars with non-state actors such as the Palestinian Liberation Organization or the Lebanese Hezbollah Group. This brought to end a series of state v state wars, which began on this day in history, 1947.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.